Today's episode of Puck Soup is sponsored by Lisa Mattresses. Lisa is on a mission to give your body the rest it needs with two awesome mattresses, plus accessories and bases for a better place to sleep. They also believe in providing a better night's sleep for everybody. And to date, they've donated more than 32,000 mattresses through more than 1,000 nonprofits. So doing good by the world is Lisa Mattresses, and also doing good by my back, too, to be honest with you. Good night's sleep, that mattress. Get 15% off your entire order at lisa.com/soup. Use the promo code soup. That's LEESA.com/soup, S-O-U-P, promo code soup. For 15% off your entire order from Lisa. And now enjoy the show.
Sticks and hits and goals and saves and slap shots and goons. We've got sportly commentary to what if you commute. But we also cover movies, TV shows, hits and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hockey and nonsense. Puck Soup.
I'm Greg Wyshynski, senior NHL writer for the worldwide leader in sports and the company creating Avatar sequels through 2025, ESPN.
Again, I just ran from Yahoo. I don't have the gravitas, apparently.
I'm Sean McEnoo from The Athletic. We might also be doing Avatar sequels at some point, but they haven't rolled it out yet, so...
Oh, do you mean because of your dramatic pivot to video with the PK Subban documentary
exactly.
You guys just put out this week?
That's,
oh, I know.
That's a thing that works, right?
New and exciting layers of PK's life. Did you guys know he donates to hospitals?
He seems
was really
like a great guy, according to all the PR I see about him from his personal brand.
But seriously, actually, one of the funniest – oh, by you're in Puck Soup. One of the funniest things about that documentary that The Athletic put out, which was finely crafted, by the way, Armin Katayan, a real pro, the Predators refused to participate in it, which I can't really wrap my brain around.
So cool. What a great sport.
Is that – here, I'll just say it. Is that an indication that PK Subban's getting traded?
Yeah.
Yep. No, I mean, clearly.
We've been saying it for – like 3 months apparently, like all of a sudden it seems like they're retconning it into, we've been talking about PK Subban getting traded for months, haven't we? It's like, I don't remember any of that, but if you say so.
I think I said it before on the show, like Subban to the Vegas Golden Knights is the single most obvious and greatest trade that could happen, which means it never would. Like how fucking perfect is that? Like he solves so many things for them. They could probably kick, you know, a few shekels over to the Predators, like Riley Smith and something, Shea Theodore or some such. It'd be a perfect trade, wouldn't it?
I don't know if I'd give up both those guys for PK Subban. coming off a down year, and he's, what, 29 now?
Yeah. Well, but someone clearly isn't thinking about the children's hospitals in Las Vegas, because they're the ones who benefit, sir. They're the ones who benefit.
29. And he's turning 30 in 4 days, so yikes.
Oh, yeah. I should really stop shit-talking PK, because I'd love to go to that 30th birthday party. Let me just put that out there.
Yeah.
Malcolm, if you're listening, can I be your plus one to your brother's party? That's all I'm asking. The playoffs are great. They continued last night. I want to start, though, with the Dallas-St. Louis series and get that out of the way. Here's the thing that I learned this week. Did you guys know that Laura Branigan, the singer of Gloria, is dead? Like, she died a long time ago?
No.
Because here's the thing. I found that out in time, in case you were wondering, as I'm writing the story about them making Gloria, their victory song. Laura Branigan still has an active Twitter feed with a blue check mark, and there was a woman throughout the playoffs who was tweeting pictures of herself in a Branigan St. Louis Blues jersey. And I mean, I didn't really scrutinize it. I definitely retweeted a few of them, assuming that this was Laura Branigan, and being like, wow, how awesome is it that this artist is getting a second wind in her career the song's taken off. It's probably on the iTunes charts, just like it used to be when songs were featured on the Ryan Murphy hit show Glee. And then I come to find out that this woman is actually her manager, and that Laura Branigan died, I think, in like 2004. And I'm going to guess that roughly 92% of the people that have seen these photos on Twitter think that's actually Laura Branigan and don't realize that she's dead.
Yeah, I guess at least it's not like a Harper Lee situation, right, where where she's being clearly exploited by people who do not have her best interests in mind. No. And also, like, Laura Branigan was actually a Nashville Predators fan or something.
Yeah, that's true. What if she was like a diehard Detroit Red Wings fan back in the day and just fucking hated the Blues?
Yeah.
And now look what happened. Like, she doesn't even have a say in any of this.
And the lesson here is don't die, I guess.
I just hope she doesn't have like any like family that's listening to this podcast and hearing this news for the first time. Like, that would be a really terrible way to find out
that she's dead.
That, like, grandma, that's why grandma hasn't been sending any more birthday cards. That would, that'd be rough.
It was very distracting because she was wearing the Branigan jersey and one assumed that was an indication that was actually Laura Branigan. So
yeah, that's the weird part. Buying a custom jersey of your dead client. That, Greg, you'd be the expert here. Is that a jersey foul, Greg?
Well, here's the thing. I'll be quite honest with you because, Ryan, you know me so well. The moment I did see the Laura Branigan jersey, I said to myself, well, that's a foul unless it's the provision in which the team bestowed the jersey on the dead Laura Branigan. Because if a team gives you a jersey with your name on the back, then you are a part of the team. I don't know if you knew that.
I mean, so, I get what you're saying, but if I guess my concern here is that this is her client. So even if the client received the jersey as a gift,
right.
I don't know, like that. Like, I'm not gonna wear a jumpsuit Elvis got if I'm Colonel Parker or whatever that guy's name was. You know what I mean?
My client, Laura Branigan.
Yeah, Paul Heyman's not wearing like tap out shirts that were given for free to Brock Lesnar.
Yeah, he's not wearing a Benoit jersey. But here's the thing about it. Like, it's not a foul if the team gives you the jersey with your name on the back. So if the Devils ever saw it fit to give my dad a Bob W. jersey instead of him having created one for himself, then that wouldn't be a foul. But unfortunately, my dad has one that the team did not give him that says Bob W. on the back. So it is totally quite a foul. Where do you stand on wearing your own name on the back of a jersey, Sean?
Yeah, I don't know. It feels fun if you're a little kid. I don't know where exactly the cutoff is. I don't get too worked up about what people do with their jerseys as long as they're not being completely stupid about it. But you don't play for the team. So past a certain age, like one of my all time favorite random hockey discoveries came from a little kid wearing his own name on his jersey, which was when I was breaking down the. You guys remember the Gary Lehman Denny Savard fight, or not fight?
Who among us
where
doesn't?
Were they
under 50?
They drop the gloves and they waltz around for 3 minutes, and it's, you know, it's this classic kind of funny weird blooper clip. But during the clip, because it's Maple Leaf Gardens, even a small child standing up blocks the camera. And this little kid stands up wearing a Leafs jersey that says Durno on the back with the number 8. And there's no player who ever played that. And there's, you know, that's not a number that anyone on the Leafs is wearing. And anyway, one way or another, ended up actually trying to get to the bottom of what that meant and discovering that it was an 8-year-old Chris Durno. And he went on to play in the NHL. He actually played for the Avalanche and had like a bit of a journeyman cup of coffee, occasional kind of type NHL career. And yeah, his Hockey Night in Canada debut was standing in front of the camera during this semi-famous moment and blocking the view of everyone who was trying to laugh at Gary Lehman.
Who was the Who was the player that got photographed at like a Sabres game and then grew up to be a player? Remember
Kane.
That?
Patrick there
was
Kane.
Like, wasn't it Patrick Kane? Yeah.
It was Patrick Kane? Wow. There you go. The stars of tomorrow in the stands of today. That's the way
I'm
it
a sucker
be.
For that. Anything like any picture of a little kid with an NHL player where that kid grows up to be in the NHL, I'm all over that. I love
Unless
those.
You're an mm-hmm. Islanders fan, in which case it's actually really bad to do that.
Yes. Not only that, but you find out your dude's a Phantom Menace fan too, if memory serves from that photograph. All right, listen, Dallas and St. Louis, the game seven was not great because it was so one-sided for most of it, but super fun to see Ben Bishop rise from the grave and play as well as he did. But, I mean, this is the uncomfortable thing about being on the road during these things is that everybody starts gossiping like a bunch of ladies getting their hair done. The only thing I heard about Ben Bishop for the last 72 hours was that everybody in the league thinks he's a giant wimp and a guy who is constantly like, if he has a hangnail, can't play. That's the thing that's out there about Ben Bishop. I don't know if it's true or not, or if it's just because of what happened to him, but that's the perception.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where if you're a goalie and you have a bad groin, and maybe if you're a 6'7" goalie and you have a bad groin or a bad knee, the impact of that injury maybe hurts you worse, and then, you know, because it's a dumb sport for idiots, everybody's like, what are you, gay or something? Like, okay, dude, we know. We get it.
I don't know what his reputation is in the hockey, like the upper levels of the hockey world, but certainly among fans, I know he's got the reputation as being a guy who also tries to sell things on the ice. Mm-hmm. And you know, we saw it a couple times in the series where he got the one where he got kind of slashed in the back that, I mean, that looked like it would have hurt, but he went down pretty hard. And then of course the big controversy in game six where he takes one off the shoulder blade. And you wonder if that maybe might've played into an extra second of hesitancy on an official's part to blow that dead, because you got a mm-hmm. guy who potentially has a reputation for milking those kind of situations.
We're going to talk about the officials a lot probably today, unfortunately, but like let's start with the baseline question, which is bouncing around. It's a theory that Elliot Friedman put out and a few others have put out. Do you believe that the officials have gotten more gun shy because of what happened in the Vegas series?
I think for those specific plays, I think so. Yeah. I think like the Charlie McAvoy hit. Yes. I think you could make the case that it was the officials were kind of victimized by a weird rule that we all learned that there is no such thing as just a run of the mill major for a check to the head, which doesn't make sense and probably should be fixed. But also, yeah, I could see them maybe sitting there going, all right, we're trying to decide between 2 and 5 because there's a match penalty. So they do still have that option. If we err on the side of the higher penalty, we could wind up like the other officials who kind of lost their playoff work because of it. So let's go the other way and go 2. And you know, obviously I think most of us thought that was also the wrong call. So I don't know. Yeah. It's a tough job. I suppose it probably is having at least some sort of an impact.
What do you think, Ryan?
Yeah, no, I agree with all of that. I feel like too, I don't know where I would have seen it, but I feel like I saw something about they told somebody after the game or something like that that they didn't see – they saw that it was head contact, but they didn't see the full extent of it, and it's not something you can review, so
– Well, and it's something where to call a match penalty, it has to be intent to injure. And I know people will say, well, any hit to the head is intent to injure, but it's not. I mean, theory, yeah, at least – in theory, if you can hit someone in the head directly and injure them, and it's still not a match penalty if it's just a hit where you were going for the chest and you caught the head instead, which is bad. Like that's but this is one of those things where, you know, there's been a few of these in these playoffs. I know we're all bitching about the officiating, but there have been a few cases where it's the rule book is the problem, not so much the official. Same thing with the puck that went into the netting. You know, the officials blew it by missing the puck going out, but then, you know, people are mad that the play continued and it wasn't reviewed and overturned, well, that's what the rule says. Well, change the rule if you don't like it.
Yeah, let's just get into it then, because as we do the show, last night was game seven between the Sharks and the Avalanche. The offside overturned goal thing in the second period was a huge moment in that game. And I think you're right. Like the prevailing thing for me, Sean, from that situation was, for the umpteenth time in these playoffs, there's a conversation about the application of video review, but there's also a conversation about the absurdity of the rule book, which I think is the core problem in a lot of these situations. And like last night, we're all watching it for the press box. None of us can even recall this happening before, mm-hmm. where a guy on a change gets whistled for being offside on a play like that. And we're all kind of like, okay, but he's, you know, if he's not necessarily on the ice, right? Like, if you can't get a too many men penalty, it's for simply standing
men.
Like there.
A lot of people are saying that, you know, that's
right,
too
no, no,
many
no,
men.
But I'm just saying that.
He's not. He doesn't, like, for the purpose of too many men, he doesn't exist anymore. But for the purpose of offside, he does.
That's what I'm
insane.
Talking about. Like,
that's
insane.
Stupid.
Yeah, like either you're a non-playable character or you are. Like it's like that's the part that people can't wrap their brains around. Is that, like, we know from all of our experience and watching too many men situations that Landeskog is, like, invisible at that point, and yet in this play he's on the ice and he's offside
and his skate was a quarter inch off the ice too.
Yeah. Like, so a couple things though, because first of all, like, yes, he is no longer part of the play because he's at the bench. But if that puck goes over to him and rattles around in his skates, he is part of the play. And it would be too many men at that point, because he goes back to being the sixth guy. So, I mean, you could argue that, you know, he is part of the play in terms of being onside or offside. To me, there's like three levels of this. There's the rule book question, which I agree. This is we can probably debate where the problem is, but this is a very hard one to explain to anyone who's not a hockey fan.
Why
this guy kind of blinks, right? Blinks in and out of existence.
Sean, hold on. Like, not only is it hard to explain to a hockey fan, but I could not fucking believe how long it took the league to put out a statement last night. Like,
which didn't
this
say
is the
anything.
Controversial play, second period, game seven, and they wait until after the game to put out a statement. And me and LeBron are sitting next to each other in the press box, like, texting all the NHL people that we usually text in these situations, and they're all being like, we're working on it.
Yeah, but those,
like,
statements are so useless anyways. All they do is just repeat whatever the ruling is. They never
but
give
I don't
you any...
think they knew. I don't think they knew what the fuck to say last night. So, like, I think it took them a time to figure out what the fuck to say.
So, I mean, here's problem number one is the rule. Problem number two... And we probably don't want to get into the whole thing all over again, is just, like, is this even the sort of play, even if we accept that this guy is offside and he's part of the play, is this even the sort of thing we want to catch with offside reviews? Like, is this something that if you'd shown it to people in 2016 when we were just bringing review in because we thought it was going to catch Matt Duchene plays, and you said, does this goal need to come off the board? I don't think there's a single person who says, yeah, we got to make sure that those goals don't count. But here we are. So there's that piece of it too, and you know, the whole replay debate, and why are we worried about somebody having a toe in the wrong place on offside? But there's all these other rules where we could worry about it, and we don't care. We just keep going and play hockey. But the third piece of it, and Ryan kind of touched on it, but I haven't heard, like, it's almost like we've kind of skipped by it, is whether he actually was offside, because I haven't seen a view that definitively tells me he's definitely doesn't have his pinky toe touching the blue line. And I was under the impression that that's what you needed. Like, you need a clear, no doubt about it, this guy is a, you know, and I don't, maybe there's a view I haven't seen. Maybe the league has a view they haven't shared, but I see this fuzzy thing of a skate next to a blue line that maybe is touching and maybe it's not. I don't know how you consider that conclusive.
Yeah.
And overrule it. So, you know, dumb concept, dumb rule, and they didn't seem to execute on
maybe
even
wrong
how their own rule is supposed to go. Yep. So, I don't know, man. I would be seriously pissed if I was a Colorado fan or even just a hockey fan, because this is dumb that we keep doing this.
Yeah, for me, it's one of those things of, like, if you can't explain this rule to a child, it's probably not a good rule. And, like, you can't explain this to me. I'm a 36-year-old man. Like, you can't explain why this particular play, like, offside rules are kind of nebulous and that kind of stuff. Like,
Well, you see, Sally, if his skate is touching the line, the linesman will lower his arm for the delayed offside. But his skate then reverts back to the zone.
Just get rid of changing on the fly, then, and then we'll never have this problem again. Like, Jesus Christ.
Listen, I am, as you know, a fucking staunch advocate for video review, as everybody who's listened to this podcast in the last month knows. I am on one side. I am one guy on the Lost Island, and then Sean is the other guy on the Lost Island, to use that parable. And so, even I, review advocate, agree that the offside review calls have gotten fucking bonkers. And, like, there's no point to it anymore. Like, they don't have the technology to do it, which I think is the biggest issue. Like, why are we trying to do this thing where we're using a camera across the ice that obviously doesn't have the definition to really tell where the fuck Landis Cogge's skates are to determine whether or not he's on or offside? You just can't do it. You don't have the technology.
And why do we care? Like, this is the part I don't get.
It had no material impact on the play.
This clearly had none at all, right? Like, there's no right. San Jose player who is even thinking about Landis Cogge at that point. It's not like, you know, there's a defenseman who even has to think about him. But, like, you know, the argument that I've made before, because, you know, every now and then I'll say, like, why are we reviewing this in the first place? Mm-hmm. And people will say, there is a rule. It's black and white. We have the technology. We have to get it right. You know, why are we worried about where somebody's pinky toe was? Well, because we have to get it right. Mm-hmm. So my question is, how come we're not reviewing offensive zone faceoffs when they lead to a goal? Because there's very clear rules about who's allowed to be where and where you have to stand. And there's lines on the ice. And if your toe is in the wrong place, how come we're not pulling those goals off the board?
I know the answer. It's because Matt Duchene wasn't 20 seconds ahead of a faceoff.
Exactly. And the thing is, when you ask people that, their reaction is because that would be stupid. Why would we ever do that? Why would we care if somebody's toe was in the wrong place on a faceoff 20 seconds before a goal? But we're doing the same thing with offsides. Like, mm-hmm. If we're so worried about a Matt Duchene play happening once a decade, then maybe there's some way that we can do this. But 95% of these are things that have nothing to do with the play, even if it's on the rush. So what if the guy was half an inch offside? It didn't affect anything. It's just a team getting a get out of jail free card. It's just
the thing I can't stand. The thing I can't stand the most is that, like at least with goalie interference, it's a situation where if there is goalie interference and the goalie resets, then that resets the play. There's no longer goalie interference. Why don't we have the same standard for offside where if the zone entry is fucked, but yet the next minute and a half is spent in the zone where the other team has ample opportunity to clear.
In the playoffs where they had to put like 40 seconds back on the board.
Yeah. Oh, I fucking hate that.
And, you know, because the other thing is then if the puck goes out and comes back in, well, I mean, why does that even change anything? If we're saying that the play was offside, it makes no sense. I would get rid of it entirely because this is not, you know, go back to 2016. When we were all, you know, there was the Matt Duchene play, and then there was that one in overtime between Tampa and Montreal. And because it was Montreal, it got all sorts of attention. And everybody thought, yeah, we got to have this in there so that we'll catch the guys who are 3 feet offside. Go back in time, show them these plays, like these goals were taken off the board, and ask if anyone has a problem with any of those goals. Nobody does. It's just a random get out of jail free card for some teams. And it makes no sense, especially in a league where there's not enough offense to start with.
Exactly.
That's what
it's
I was
so
about to say.
Deleterious, yeah,
like, we're so concerned about we got to get back to when every game in the playoffs was 7-5 or whatever. And then we're like, but also, you know, we got to get some of these goals off the board. I mean, that guy was a quarter of an inch offside 4 minutes before it got scored. So, you know, like it's so... It's just
and they're still getting them wrong sometimes.
Constantly. Yes.
Yeah.
Like they missed one in the Boston-Toronto series. They legitimately missed a guy being offside and what are we doing? And like I don't want to get into the whole penalty debate again other than to say I can't fathom how you could look at what offside has been the last 3 years and say, you know what, let's let the same people who came up with this and think this is good enough do a way more subjective and hard to judge section of the rule book. Like I can't imagine how we look at this and go, we want more of this in the game because this is going really well.
Well, I ain't going down that rabbit hole again, but I do appreciate the fact that Ryan's right where they're like,
We need more scoring so people can bet on hockey. Also, Landis Cog's skate was the length of a pubic hair away from the blue line. So, I mean, we should really wipe out this goal.
Maybe we need one of these. I keep saying we need it to happen in like overtime of a game seven, but maybe it's not that. Maybe it needs to tilt the over-under and cost the wrong people a lot of money. And then
one could argue it already did last night. Over-under was 5.5. Yeah. They wiped that goal off the board.
So there you go. I don't know. I would do it, like, yeah. To go back to the netting play. Everybody was like all mad because how come, you know, that rule says it has to be immediate. I actually like that. I would rather have the offside if we insist on having these stupid things have the same wording. It has to be immediate or else just keep playing hockey. Sorry, guys. Somebody's toe is in the wrong place. You don't get to just quit on the play. Keep going and play to the whistle.
To speak to your earlier point, though, I can't remember another postseason where every single game there seemingly is a pop quiz about the nuances of the rule book. It ain't just like, here's a controversial play. What do you think of it? It's here's a controversial play. Oh, and subsection 12 of rule 35 says,
this does happen every year, but
a controversial play that materially alters the like outcome of the game.
Yeah. That's insane. The netting play, the offside play, the McAvoy play, many of the goalie interferences play. The one play where it was the continuation of a shot or some shit. Remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
There were so many things.
The went off the goaltender.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's like it literally feels like someone is administering a pop quiz to the hockey world on what the rule book says.
But the thing is, and this is the one time you'll probably hear me. Not even so much defending the officials, but like I said, a lot of these calls are them calling the rule book. And
yeah.
You know what? We dump on the refs all the time. I did it myself with the Cody Eakin call. I think it's completely justified to criticize these guys when they get it wrong. But I think we should also point it out when they get it right. And that the Ben Bishop play in game six where he got hurt and they counted the goal, they got that exactly right. That was 100% the right call. And if they had missed that call, like if they had blown it dead as St. Louis is putting the puck in the net, that could have changed that series. That could have cost the St. Louis Blues the series. So it's a split second call, and a referee who was standing 10 feet away got it exactly right. And I feel like we should at least mention that if we're going to bury these guys every time they get one wrong.
Right. And I think there was a certain kinship between that play and the McAvoy play where people looked at the play and said, okay, this should be a match penalty for whatever. And you're like, no, a match penalty looks like this. There's intent. It's worse than this. This is not a match penalty. You can make the argument this is a hockey hit gone wrong. And then you look at the Bishop thing, and you're like, well, they should have stopped play because of the severity of the injury. Like, no, man, like when we see play stop, it's because of there's being a Pavelski situation or a guy that gets knocked out or some shit. Like, this is not that.
You can't have a rule in the rule book that says if the other team has the puck and is about to score in the defensive zone, anybody on the defensive team getting hurt immediately stops the play. Like, yeah,
it's insane.
But it's not anybody. It's the fucking goalie.
And so right? So like, put that rule in. And like, let me be clear. I'm not – Ben Bishop wasn't faking on this one. Like, you get hit in the collarbone. That – even though he stayed in the game, this isn't a guy faking. But we are – I mean, we already have this situation where we have a rule where if the helmet comes off, the play stops, which you have to have, of course. And we see goalies shake it off all the time. Like, goalies absolutely take advantage of this any opportunity they get. We saw Tuukka Rask do it a few nights ago.
Tuukka Rask did it, yeah.
They just drop the helmet off and, oh, it's automatic whistle, plays over. So if you don't think they'd be doing that with injuries, I don't know. You're more – maybe I'm too cynical here. But, we're going to see a lot of goaltenders rolling around. The only way you could do it is if you had a rule that said we automatically blow the play dead, but the goalie's got to come out for the rest of the period or something like that.
Ryan, do you think they should have – Ryan, do you think they should have whistled down?
Yeah. I mean, like, it wasn't a thing where he gave up the rebound and they immediately batted it into the net. Like, there was a pass after.
Yeah, it was 3 seconds, though. It wasn't like they were setting up and going back and forth on the point. Like, it was, 3 seconds. That's a – 3 seconds is not that long a time, man.
Get a whistle up to your mouth and blow it dead.
It is.
The goalie is writhing around on the ice in obvious pain.
End the play in your mind.
It's also enough time to get your puck on the stick then, you know? Like, play some defense, guys. It's you know, the rule is there for a reason. They called it exactly correctly. Then change the rule and get used to seeing a lot of goaltenders rolling around on the ice.
Let me do that though, Sean.
All right.
Not yet.
I hope you like flopping goaltenders because we're going to get a whole lot of them.
Have you fucking seen any of the playoffs? If you look at a goalie wrong within 4 inches of the crease, they're going to fall down like you stabbed them.
So, exactly. Like, and they don't get an automatic stoppage when that happens. So you think that problem's going to get better?
I agree with Ryan, I'm surprised they didn't whistle it because of the way they treat goalies. But at the end of the day, I mean, the play has to continue. That's not a severe enough penalty where unless you have an injury. Like, unless you have a fucking MRI machine on the ice to figure out exactly where it hit him and how hurt he is, like, you don't have any concept of what he's going through at that moment.
The only reason I was surprised is that from watching it on TV, the nature of the shot, for a second, I thought it could have hit him in the throat. And that is one of the situations where, you know, they will immediately stop it. But at the same time, the referee was standing 10 feet away. So maybe the referee just guessed.
Standing 10 feet away, never fuck up a call. That's true.
Well, but he got it right. I mean, now we're mad at the referees because he could have hypothetically been wrong, even though he was exactly right. Like, this is getting silly now. Like, these guys have to go into some alternate universe and get the calls right there, too. Like, he was exactly right. He hit him in the collarbone. He wasn't hurt badly enough to leave the game. The ref got that one exactly right.
I agree. I think he did too. I just get possession back if your goalie's hurt, and no one can conceive on how hurt the goalie is at that moment too. And I think, you know, I hate to play. I'm playing right into the fucking Down Goes Brown playbook now to be like slippery slope, but it is a slippery slope. Like, if you give the benefit of the doubt at all times to a goalie, like, he can literally just stop play whenever on every fucking shot if he wanted to.
Okay, sure.
And then they'll be marrying dogs, Ryan. So Pat Maroon scores. His kid is very happy. That was a beautiful thing. The Blues advance. And the Sharkies advance. And I'm happy that Colorado lost because I feel like their best years are ahead of them. Like, they didn't need to win this year.
No.
I think they're going to be fine.
They get the fourth overall pick.
The fourth overall pick. Everybody on the team is like 23. So we get the Sharks and the Blues, which I think is a really good Western Conference final. Who do you like? Who's your pick in that Western Conference final?
As long as Martin Jones doesn't turn back into Martin Jones, where I think it's pretty smooth sailing for the Sharks.
Smooth? I mean, I think it's going to be a long series. I think the Blues are a tough out with Bennington, I agree with you, though.
Right. I mean, it'll be a long series, but in much the same way, I just kind of thought it was smooth sailing for the Blues in this series. Like, they should be considered the favorite, and they'll probably win. And it, like, being the favorite doesn't mean you win in five games. Being the favorite means you don't...
You win.
Yeah, exactly.
So. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that. I'm picking St. Louis largely because I am already way too excited about a San Jose Boston Joe Thornton Stanley Cup final.
Come on.
And
right?
So I'm just assuming that that would be so good and so much fun that there's no way we get it. So I'm kind of sticking with my beginning of the playoffs bandwagon pick and going with the Blues. But it should be a great series. We'll get into the East later, but we wound up with two real good series. This is going to be a fun next few weeks.
I picked the Blues to come out of the West before the playoffs started, but like what the Sharks have done is pretty fucking impressive. Like to do what they did against Colorado without having Pavelski for the majority of the series. And they've got this kind of now cosmic thing going on where they're getting shit like the Game 7 calls that we saw. So there's something going on there, too. Plus, I think they figured out how to win with Martin Jones, which is to A, never allow a shot attempt on the rush. B, in the words of Gabe Landeskog, swarm the net around their goaltender. That's not to say he didn't play well in the waning moments of Game 7 last night. He was really good. But I think that they have reduce the liability of a Martin Jones in these series in a concerted way, and I think it's helped them overall defensively because they did a real fucking number on McKinnon's line in that series. So I'll take the Sharks in that series too, I think.
Yeah, I just the key to victory for the Blues, do not let it get to a seventh game, because the Sharks have magic powers in game seven, and I don't...
We'll get screwed by the officials.
I do not necessarily want to know what horrible thing the hockey gods have in mind for a game seven of the conference final, especially against the St. Louis Blues. Oh, I got to mention this one other thing, just because it just made me laugh, because I wrote a thing on Tuesday where I basically did a whole post celebrating the history of goaltenders giving up really horrible goals, because that's just something I like. I'm into goaltenders giving up goals.
Fucking sadist.
And the thing is, I put it out, like, it was on Tuesday. That was just kind of where we had it scheduled, and we dropped it out there, and I didn't even really think anything of it. But immediately I get all these responses from Blues fans who are like, no, screw you. Not on game seven day. I'm not opening this. I'm not looking at it. And the thing is, in the first type of goal that I said that I love is those long distance bounce goals, like the Vesa Toskala one. And sure enough, with 15 seconds in regulation, Jamie Benn from center ice bounces one right in front of Jordan Binnington. And I got so many replies from Blues fans who were like, dude, I would have come to your house and murdered you if that had gone in, because every Blue, I swear to you, 90% of Blues fans watching that play unfold thought that was the winning goal. For sure. Like they were just so used to expect the worst, bounce it over his shoulder, and that would be the end of it.
They're an underrated, psychologically damaged fan base.
Absolutely.
Like we'll talk about one later in Edmonton, but that Blues one is a real underrated, psychologically
52
damaged
years.
Fan base. There it is. All right. Moving on. The East is fun. So yeah. I think we're all on different pages when it comes to the Jackets. Because, Ryan, I know that you don't think that the all-in thing was worth it to lose in the second round. I kind of think it was, just because of the previous levels of success for that franchise. And shooting your shot seemed like the smartest decision at the deadline. But I understand the counterpoint, which is that what's the fucking point of mortgaging that much treasure just to go out in six in the second round?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just the entire draft that they traded this year, except for, I think, their fourth round pick. It's the fact that they don't now have a pick in the first two rounds in the next two drafts. They don't have a second round pick in three drafts from now. They don't have a third round pick, I think, this year or next. You can just go down the list and be like, oh, man. Like, if you look at the top of their cap-friendly page, you're like, wow, they do not have a lot of picks early on for quite a while. And, you know, I know they have a lot of young talent on that team and some guys that are still, you know, coming into the program the next couple of years and all that kind of stuff. But it's a lot of high draft picks to give up. And I'm not saying it's not worth it, because maybe they hit some home runs with their later picks, and then you don't think about, well, we didn't have our first round pick as much, right?
Right.
But right now I'm kind of leaning toward, I get why you guys did this, and I'm glad that somebody went for it like this, but if in 3 years we're still talking about, and this Columbus team has never even come close to winning in the second round.
Yeah.
Like, then you go, well, I guess I don't see the point then, especially if it keeps John Tortorella in that job, which I think is maybe not. I think that's maybe what kept them in the 8 seed all year.
He plays to the bubble.
Yep.
Yeah.
Always has.
I agree with pretty much everything Ryan said, but there's just – like, they just had the best playoff run that they've had in nearly two decades. And I'm not even talking about where they – how far they went, because obviously they, you know, they fell well short of winning a Stanley Cup. But at some point as a fan base, you got to start making some memories, and you got to start having some moments. And they got a few of those this year that they haven't had. And I think there's value in that. And I've beaten this drum before. I can't get on board with this idea that every year one team wins the Stanley Cup and everybody else failed. Because I think that's a miserable way to sell your league. 97% of fans are supposed to feel bad every year by the end of the season. No, they're not. It's you know, obviously the Stanley Cup's the ultimate goal, but you can have a year where you don't win the Stanley Cup, and it can still be a great year, and it can be a year that makes new fans. or maybe brings back some of those lapsed fans. And there's value in that. And, you know, if you're Columbus, like, you know, at some point you gotta win a round. And they, they did that. They did it in one of the most memorable upsets that we've seen in recent history. You know, we always say when you look at a team like the Panthers or even the Hurricanes and you say, well, the attendance and this and that, people always say, yeah, but they don't win. Well, eventually you got to win. You got to win something. And it's been almost 20 years for these guys. I get, you know, the argument might be that this wasn't the time to do it. But part of the reason people were saying it wasn't the time is because you were just going to get crushed by the Lightning, and that didn't happen. And, you know, I don't know how many new Blue Jackets fans did we make this year? I don't know. Maybe not many, or maybe, you know, maybe this is the start of something. But I don't mind seeing a team go for it, and I don't want to sit here and say that it was a failure just because they didn't win the cup, even though you're right, they are going to pay for it down the line, and maybe the timing wasn't exactly what it should have been.
The best way to make a new fan is to live and die with your team in the postseason. That's like the best formula to create a hockey fan.
And sometimes you gotta live and not just die year after year after year, because that's not how you build a new fan. So
I like your thought on the winning the cup and everybody else is a failure thing. But would you agree though that there are teams that can be failures if they don't reach a certain plateau of the postseason? Like if the Sharks had lost last night to Colorado, I would consider this season a failure,
right?
Based on what their investment and based on what's going to happen this summer.
Yes. I agree totally. I mean there are teams that just making the playoffs is a victory, and then there's teams that go out in the first round and it's a disaster. It depends on the context, depends where you are. But if you're, you know, how many years have we all been making jokes about the Blue Jackets never winning a round? Well, that's off the table now, at least. Like, they got that moment, at least. And then they got it in one of the most spectacular ways possible. So, that's worth something. Yeah, and so
the thing I said all along was that they needed to get to the Eastern Conference Final. You know, the extra... Mm-hmm. The extra four home dates
that would have put it over the edge.
I think this is one where you can make the argument that it was worth it, but where it very definitively becomes worth it is if you make the conference final and they and like, you know, they had to go up against, I would say, two of the three best teams in the league this year, maybe even the top two, and that's not necessarily fair to them, but also, you know, they were the eight seed, so that's what you get.
Yeah, I just come at this like my as a sports fan, I grew up as a Blue Jays fan, and the Toronto Blue Jays, they won two World Series in my lifetime, and then they went 20 years of just doing nothing, and there's so many, they lost so many fans, you know, just people like me. I was a lifelong fan. I knew I could name every single player on those 80s and 90s teams. I couldn't name anybody from like 2012, and then they made the playoffs and we got the bat flip. And they didn't win the World Series. So was that your failure? You know, they gave up a lot. They made all those big offseason trades, kind of had a Blue Jackets type push. And they didn't win. So was that a failure? Yeah, you know what? Well, no, not at all. I would not trade anything for that
playoffs
moment.
For another 5 years. And you
The Blue Jays haven't. Give me that moment. Like, you have to have some moments as a fan at some point, or else you don't, you know, you're not just going to pull them back. And I get the idea that maybe they should have kind of held off and maybe next year was the better year or the year after. But I also think it's
maybe a no-win situation, because it's like, well, you can't lose two franchise type players for nothing, and so like you have, so like the, and you know, frankly, if this team misses the playoffs or whatever, probably the coach gets fired, maybe the GM gets fired, and so like there was also like the thing of, okay, well, this is a guy trying to save his job, I get that.
Yeah, I think, and I also think that they've got, I mean, they've got some stuff
really
on
like
that roster.
A lot of players on their roster.
Dubois is going to be great. Like, they've got Werenski and Jones in perpetuity. I think Korpisalo is going to be
so good.
I think Korpisalo is going to be an all right goalie. Like, it's we had John Davidson on the other podcast, and you know, as he was, you know, packing up his bags from New York, and said he said, you know, we made these deals at the deadline because we thought we could. Like, we thought we had enough in reserve that we thought we could part with some assets to do this thing. And I mean, believe him or not, but I do think that the Blue Jackets are still in pretty decent shape, although obviously there's no way to replace
a franchise goalie and a franchise winger, yeah.
Well, I think there's a way to replace Bobrovsky, but Panarin is irreplaceable.
Bobrovsky has the best save percentage in the league over the last seven seasons. He's
sure, but
arguably
the best goalie
in the world.
He's also like 31. Like at some point,
well,
it's going to start.
Right. I mean, by that, like the Bruins should trade Patrice Bergeron. Like should be fine letting Patrice Bergeron walk. Like,
all right. No, I understand what you're saying.
And look, I'm fully in favor of trade everybody on their 30th birthday. That's, I think, a pretty decent way to manage your franchise over the course of a long enough period of time. But with that having
been said, a bit of a Logan's Run outlook on life there,
yeah,
Brian Lambert.
But, like, you're playing a game where most guys are washed at 30. Or, if not washed, getting close to it. And you got to maximize their value and all that kind of thing, so...
Lambert, how well do you know the 1992 Toronto Blue Jays?
You know, zero.
Ah, damn. I thought we could do an impromptu roster game with you and Down Goes Brown, but...
How would I know anything about the 1992 Blue Jays?
Well, I collected baseball cards like a motherfucker back in the day.
It would just be the same result as all the other quizzes, so, I mean, it wouldn't really...
Oh, shit. There it is. Tailored to your expertise, and then I get all the hard ones. Right, I agree.
So I think we all agree with the Blue Jackets. It was the right idea. Maybe just the timing wasn't there. Speaking of the timing not being there, I was supposed to do an ad during the last segment, and I didn't realize we were done talking about the Sharks and Avalanche. So I'm going to do it now. The Athletic. Gentlemen, is a direct-to-consumer subscription service serving sports fans in North America. The model is simple. There are no ads, no pop-ups, no autoplay videos. Instead, readers subscribe for authentic, in-depth coverage written and now spoken by journalists who know the league inside and out. You can get all of the league-wide news from NHL experts like Pierre LeBrun, Katie Strang, Craig Custance.
Pierre LeBrun.
Go on down the list. Lots of good draft content going up there too these days. So if your team isn't in the playoffs and you're already looking ahead, you can sink in there, as well as local coverage for every team in the league. So what you can do is go to theathletic.com/soup. You get a 40% off discount to The Athletic. That's theathletic.com/SOUP, all lowercase, SOUP, for 40% off. That ends up being like $2.99 a month. In the US, I think it's like $3.50 Canadian. It gets you more than 1,000 stories published each week.
Less
across all
than the
of
price
these sports.
Of a cup of coffee. Yeah.
Less than the price of a cup of coffee. As well as audio content and video content that just launched this week. So subscribe right now using promo code SOUP. Download the Athletic app from the App Store. Come experience the Athletic stories told in a whole new way.
And to put a cherry on it, I don't know what the fuck you're doing if you don't have the Athletic subscription during the playoffs. Like, every team has the best beat writer, you know, for the most part, working for the Athletic now. And it's great. And, like, if you're someone like me who's looking to figure out what the hell's going on with the opponent in a series, because I'm like, you know, I mean, it's the best resource, because not only is it the shit that's happening now, but then you dip into the archives and figure out what happened during the season.
Yep. And if your team is out, they're already doing a ton of stuff on what the offseason is going to hold, who's going to get traded, what are they going to get traded for, all of that kind of stuff. So it's the only reason not to subscribe is if you don't have a couple hours to get lost reading a lot of really good stuff, because it is.
Or you've committed your resources to the Patreon for Puck Soup. I mean, there's
that too. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is.
All right,
that.
Sean. Starting lineup for the 1992 Toronto Blue Jays. Let's start with the easy one, first base.
Okay. Bugs so let's Bunny. Go around the
second base. Bugs Bunny.
Yeah. They go around. The catcher was Pat Borders. It was a little bit of a
platoon
situation, but a World Series MVP. First base was John Olerud. That was the year before
right.
he hit the he won the batting title.
Mets
Robbie
legend.
Alomar, shortstop. Who was shortstop that? They didn't get Fernandez till the next year. I'm gonna was Manny Lee still there?
Damn right, it's Manny Lee.
Third base would have been, that I think was Kelly Gruber's last year.
Damn. Oh, absolutely. One of my favorite Blue Jays of all time.
The outfield was obviously Carter, White, and
this is the tough one. This is the real tough one.
By the end of the year, it was Candy Maldonado. I don't know if he started like the opening
day. That is correct.
And then
Candy Maldonado played 137 games. So I would say that he played the majority of the games in left field.
And then Dave Winfield as the DH. And I believe the opening day starter would have been Jack Morris.
How deep can you go on that rotation? Jack Morris.
Jack Morris, Juan Guzman. Dave Steeb was actually on that team, but I don't think he was the starter.
He counts. Yeah, sure.
Let's see, Jimmy Key. They traded for David Cohn. They had, I think they had Stottlemyre and David Wells as well. Pat Hankton, I don't think, came in until
he didn't start.
Yeah.
What a fucking, look at this sound of this bullpen. David Wells, mm-hmm. Dwayne Ward, Pat Hankin, and Tom Hankey.
Hankey,
good Lord.
Yep, bullpen was fantastic, and yet it was Mike Timlin who got the save on the first World Series, inducing.
What
the,
a fun team that was!
It was Ryan, Mike Timlin and Joe Carter playing first base.
I collected a lot of baseball cards as a kid. I collected more like the baseball card to basketball and hockey card ratio was probably like 80-1. I was a huge baseball card collector when I was a kid.
Yeah,
that's the only reason I know this shit.
Did you get really way too into the error cards where like there'd be like a line in the wrong place and you're sitting there looking at like you're like you got like your Roily Jones with a line over the L and you're like, this is going to be worth a lot of money someday.
Absolutely. Especially if it was a good player. But then, there were times when, and Don Russ was famous for like flipping their images on cards. And it got to the point where I started to wonder if it was like the Cabbage Patch Kid effect, where they're just like the Cabbage Patch Kids, they didn't make enough of them to create demand. And the error cards, I'm like, they're clearly fucking these up on purpose in order to create a buzz about their sets, right? Yep. Like, there's no way that Ripken card gets through without someone noticing it says fuckface on the bottom of his back.
I don't
know.
Like, there was a freaking coffee cup on Game of Thrones this week. You hear about this, Greg?
I can't believe that shit.
Somebody should have tweeted that. That's crazy.
There was, and I'll tell you, like, there was a great post on like Mashable or one of those sites that did a thing of actual other fuck ups on Game of Thrones. Like, apparently there was another scene where you could see a visible laptop cord coming from like one of the characters' legs.
I remember there's a scene where you can very clearly, like, you know, it was one of those things from Twitter where you can very clearly see Jaime Lannister holding a Tim Hortons cup.
did he roll? Did he roll the lid to see if he had won?
You know, it was. You know, you play roll up the rim to win. You live. You win or you die. Right? So,
such is the Game of Thrones. There was also that infamous one where the dude was wearing a full like denim outfit in the background of one of the shots. That was an actual thing.
That's the only way you would have got Canadians. The Canadians wouldn't have been mad about the Tim Hortons cup, but anybody rolling up the rim and actually winning would have been such an unrealistic plot point. We just all would have.
We can deal with. We can wrap our head around the dragons.
So wait, is
fine, but anybody winning more than a muffin in roll up the rim? No way.
Sounds like the Tim Hortons roll up the rim is akin to the McDonald's Monopoly promotion in which everybody wins like free fries, but no one actually wins anything of substance.
Isn't there like a whole insane community around the McDonald's Monopoly? I think I read a thing about that.
Yeah, where, like on eBay, they like.
And there was this whole this scam, right? Where like somebody was somebody who worked there was like shipping off the winning pieces.
Yep. I have to say, Wendy's recently did one for March Madness that. Like I won, I think every time I got something from Wendy's, and it was always just like, you know, a free large drink, a free sandwich, free 4-piece nugget. But that's more than I ever got.
It adds up.
Years of playing McDonald's. So
yeah, I don't understand why they make it so hard to win these things. Like in theory, if you win a large fry, you're going to certainly come back and buy a fucking soda.
Yeah,
or something
it would
right?
always be like a free large soda with any purchase, and I go, well, I'm going to Wendy's anyway. I'll just get the soda.
Right, exactly. It's incentive at the end of the day. You don't have to give me a boat. You just give me like a free drink. All right, real brief. We didn't touch on the whole totality of the Eastern Conference Final. Boston, Carolina. I'm picking Boston in the series. I just think they're playing out of their minds right now, and all due respect to Carolina, but like, I just think Boston's a little bit better.
Yeah, I would agree with that. My favorite twist of this is that this is somehow now like a referendum on Dougie Hamilton as a person again.
Oh yeah, there it
like,
is.
There was a big article on one of the local sports websites that was like, Dougie Hamilton still doesn't know why he was traded. And it's like, I mean, he does. He definitely does. He's not going to tell you, but the answer probably has a lot to do with, I don't know, his tendency to go to museums, maybe, something along those lines. I've never understood it from, you know, what people have told me is, like, he just didn't fit in with the culture, and that was a Bruins team that was obsessed with culture and all that shit.
Yeah, and there was also, I think, a money component, too, at some point, right, where he was asking for more than they wanted to give him or some shit? Or was that just a cover story?
Yeah, I feel like they offered him whatever they were, like, he ended up taking with Calgary, so who knows, but yeah, no, it was definitely, like, a culture thing first and foremost, and then, you know, the other thing is that, of course, like, they, one of the local sports talk shows had a guy... had a guy from one of the Carolina papers on and hung up on him instantly because they were like, he has a southern accent? Like making fun of his accent. And it's like, this horrible city has the worst accent you could possibly imagine. Like, you take 80 calls a day. Yeah, what if we package Nola Chari and Zdeno Chara, and maybe we could get Connor McDavid back. What do you think? You think they maybe have to throw in Dreisaitl to make it more fair? And they're like, oh, that's a great point. You know, horseshit.
The craziest part of that story is that they decided to make fun of his accent instead of ridiculing Luke DeCock's name, which is pretty an upset, I think, for Boston Radio.
It was Chip Alexander.
Chip Alexander's got the kind Southern gentleman Tom Wolfe kind of accent.
I do want to say he did make a mistake by declaring that he thought.
Just before we go off Dougie Hamilton, do we all agree that he should be awarded the Conn Smythe Trophy right now for doing the head pat in the handshake?
The head pat kicked ass, dude. That was kicked ass.
It was so good. It was perfect. All right, so bunch of jerks versus massholes. It sounds like Ryan and I like Boston. Sean, you like Boston too, or you like Carolina?
I do like Boston. I'm picking Carolina partly. I'm partly this is me doing my George Costanza go against whatever I think is going to happen strategy, and partly again, just there's no way they're actually going to give us that Boston San Jose series that we all want so badly. So I'm steering hard in the other direction, and I'm saying we're going to get the Blues and Hurricanes, because the two things we can't have are the Joe Thornton series or. And I kind of hope we don't get this one, is the Carolina-San Jose series, so that everybody is making Sharknado jokes for the entire 2 weeks, and which will be funny for about the first 7 seconds.
Nobody's even going to watch. The ratings are going to be bad, like anybody gives a shit.
Ratings are good these playoffs so far, though. People are digging the upsets. Is St. Louis-Carolina the demonstrably worst cup final on the table?
They've been unbelievable for quite a while.
Seems like it could be a lot of 2-1 games to me.
Yeah, I don't feel like there is a it's probably the worst of four pretty good matchups. Like, I don't feel like that's a bad matchup.
One of them is fine with me, honestly.
I think the problem is that Boston San Jose is clear. That's like fucking Avengers Endgame in this scenario. Like, it is the marquee of marquee matchups, not only for the Thornton thing, but like, Give me Brad Marchand in a series against the Sharks.
Give us St. Louis, Carolina, and we just turn it into like the Rod Brind'Amour revenge. And like people got to ask him like any payback on St. Louis, and he'd be like, "Did I play for St. Louis? Like, I don't even I don't recall that."
He's like, "Yeah, I can't believe they offered me up in the Scott Stevens compensation that time." Mm-hmm. It's the Brad Marchand versus Logan Couture matchup that we all want in our hearts is really what we want in that series, and it would be fucking glorious. Fucking glorious. All right, well, there you go. Okay, so that's the whole playoff bit. The guest this week is Bill Camp. If you don't know Bill Camp, you've probably seen Bill Camp.
He was the theme of the Met Gala this week, is that right?
Yeah! That's right. Who among us didn't love when Lena Dunham showed up dressed as Bill Camp? So he was on The Night Of. He got an Emmy nomination for it. He's been in a ton of different movies, but mostly he is the voice currently of all of the NHL documentary stuff. So Quest for the Stanley Cup, Road to the Winter Classic. Quest for the Stanley Cup right now is on ESPN Plus in the U.S. and YouTube.com/NHL in Canada, chronicling all the teams that are in the playoffs. It's a 7-episode run that goes through June 14th. So you can catch it on ESPN Plus. Really good dude. We get into some hockey stuff. He's a big Bruins fan. And then we also talk about some of his roles, including getting thrown off the roof by Jason Bourne and being in Ryan, the Joker movie. He's in the Joker movie. Oh, yeah. All right, here's Bill Camp. Bill, you are the voice once again for the Quest for the Stanley Cup show for the NHL and all of their various Ross Greenberg documentary things. The thing I always like about you doing this show is it always makes me think of the old NFL films vibe, you know, turning on ABC in the middle of the afternoon when I was a kid and watching an NFL films production. Was that ever an influence for you?
Oh man, that's such a great compliment. I can't tell you how, like, in a way, like that's sort of the. Really, I'm very flattered. Yeah, I mean, I don't try and be like that, but absolutely, that's that influenced me because I had the same thing as a sports fan, you know, turning on and listening to those docs, those mini docs that I can't even remember that guy's name now. I feel embarrassed.
Yeah.
But yeah,
Was it Warner Fusell?
Sports voice.
Was it Warner Fusell, I want to say, was the guy who did them? I forget if that was the dude's name or not, but that's the name kicking around in my head. But it's always good. And like, you need that sort of, you know, voice of God kind of overseer when it comes to these sort of documentaries. And I feel like you really capture that.
That's cool. Thanks. I really appreciate that.
How did you get hooked up with the NHL in the first place for doing these things?
I think the first thing I did was in 2013, and that was with Ross, and that was Road to the Winter Classic. That was the first one they did. I think it was, I can't remember. I think it was Epics. And it just happened to be the Bruins. It was the Bruins and the Habs. I think it was that year was the first year I did it. And they contacted my voiceover agent, Stephen Arcieri, and he's got a number of guys in his stable that do, you know, long copy doc stuff, which I'd done before. And Ross asked him, you know, who he had, because Liev is in the same office, and Liev, I think, was like, nah, I got, you know, enough. You know, or Ross was looking for something different, or it was a new deal with the NHL and hockey. And so, I read something, or they listened to some, I think they listened to some demo stuff I had done. And, you know, Ross gave it the thumbs up, and that was the beginning. And, you know, it's just been a great privilege and a wicked fun ride since.
Did you listen to any of Liev's old stuff from the HBO version of the show to kind of get the vibe, or were you just looking to do your own thing?
You know, I've known Liev for a very long time, so I kind of know his cadence anyways. But, yeah, you know, any smart person who's doing this is my opinion. If you're going to do that stuff, he, again, like that NFL films guy, Liev is, but in a totally different category, obviously, in a different, almost vocal genre. Liev is so good at what he does. I'm amazed at what he does with just, you know, 24/7 and Hard Knocks and anything he puts his voice down for. So yeah, I listened to some stuff he did and knew I couldn't copy him, but he has a great rhythm. He's got great phrasing. He was reading, I think, for the same guys that were writing the copy that I was doing, Steve Stern and Aaron Cohen. So I kind of got a vibe also as to, because really that's the most important thing, right? Are the words that I'll be saying. So
right.
The way those guys the way they write and their phrasing and their rhythms and the stuff that they put down, it was good for me to listen to. And it's just an added plus to listen to Liev do it because it's so subtle and yet it's, you know, it's so powerful.
Oh, yeah. What's the take us behind the curtain. What's the turnaround for you on doing one of these things?
So I will actually, it varies. Like tomorrow, I have to be in Atlanta. So I'll go to a studio probably. Well, I'm shooting tomorrow in Atlanta, so I'll go there later. These guys have taken all of their footage, right? All of their incredible, which is really the highlight of the show, right? Is all of the access stuff that they get with Ross's teams at the different venues and in the locker rooms and sometimes at home and on off days, but mostly action and that incredible stuff. So they edit that, and Steve has written a script. And so I'll probably walk into a studio down in Atlanta at about 7:30 p.m., which is generally a little later than a couple hours later than when I do it here in New York. And then I'll just walk into a booth. I'll have, you know, a swipe at it, just looking at it and reading it. Steve will come over and he and I will, you know, BS for a while because he's just an awesome guy and we've gotten to be good pals. And, so, and then Ross will come over and he'll have a putter in his hand or something and we'll talk some more, whatever. I mean, really, Greg, it's that much of a blast. It's such a blast for me. And then I'll, you know, wander into the booth and I'll start reading and, you know, Steve will give me a couple of notes and Denny from the NHL and Ross will be in the room in their little, you know, engineer's room listening as well with Steve and the engineer Keith and, you know, and then they'll give me a couple things to do and I'll either do them or not. And we'll move on. Like either I'll take their notes well or good enough and then we'll move on or I won't be able to do it at all and then we'll move on.
I mean, are there times when you're doing this where you just can't seem to get the vibe right?
Absolutely.
Oh yeah?
Definitely. I mean, way more in the beginning because it's like anything sort of, you know, vibey, you fall into a pocket with it, right? And sometimes I will I'll just have a too slow energy, or I'll have a too fast energy, or I'll get over dramatic on the open. Sometimes there are words and phrases that I'll just, you know, it's the actor's nightmare in the booth. Or even anywhere else where you just, like, you say something too many times and then it loses its meaning and then you're just making the Kafka of it all. And it's like, I can't even say the words anymore. And then the brilliant thing about it is that we can go on. We'll go on to the next segment and then we'll come back and do it and I will have sort of established myself remotely. But that was pretty much, you know, that happened more often in the first year or two.
Oh yeah,
now
for sure.
It's kind of like we just have a great time, you know. We have a lot of laughs and get it done.
It's awesome. And, what did I was going to ask you? What did the Bruins mean to you? I know you're a huge Bruins fan. What have they meant to you through the years?
So just to give you some information to set some groundwork. Right now, at this moment, I am at my house, my apartment, that I share with my wife and my 12-year-old son. And I'm looking at a circa 1971 trash can that has a big B in the spokes and an illustration of Bobby Orr on it. And then I have, I got a lot of like Bruin sweatshirts, pants, t-shirts, hats. My wife buys me a lot of that swag, but, you know, they've been my team since I was about four. When I first got turned on to hockey was in Massachusetts where I grew up. And they were broadcast on a WSBK TV 38, which was a UHF station.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, so So really, you know, they've always been my team. And I got back into really following them, I would say around 2008.
Oh, yeah.
Because for about
you and the rest of Boston.
Years, I sort of like peripherally would keep sort of an eye on, like, you know, if I happen to glance at the sports page or if I, you know, happen to have ESPN on for some reason, because there was a period where I didn't watch a lot of television. I would sort of hear about stuff. And then, fortunately, I got back into them. I was in Connecticut, working in Connecticut. And I started, I just turned on the television, and they had, like, they had those, you know, 60-minute, those replay games. It was, like, 2 in the morning, and they would replay the game that had happened at 7. But yeah, they do it without commercials, and they cut some boring stuff or something. And so it's like you get it in an hour. I don't know what it is. So I started watching the Bruins again. And then I was like, this is an awesome game. I love this game. I love this team. It just sort of made me feel, I don't know, what is it, nostalgic? Or it was like,
yeah,
I started to feel the excitement that I felt as a kid. All the goofy stuff, which is really quite pure stuff. And I liked it. And I thought, well, this makes me feel good. I'm going to stay with it.
So it was interesting because I think there was that great sort of reawakening in Boston about the Bruins around that time. You know, when Tim Thomas is there and Chara's on the team, and it just seemed like the entire city, like something was unlocked in that city for that incarnation of the Bruins team, and it's kind of stayed that way since.
I think I totally agree with you. I think I was so fortunate to have sort of thrown some attention towards those games and the team again at that time, because then it was what, a year later or something, they won the cup, or 2 years later they won the cup.
Yeah.
And I had a 3 or 4 year old son at that time, so I can remember vividly in our living room, I had on my Orr shirt and he had on a Bergeron shirt.
Oh wow.
As a 4 year old. And he was like, he's not like a big hockey, he's a swimmer, you know, but he goes with it, you know, he goes with it. And he's seen a bunch of games with me. I just vividly when they beat the Canucks and we were standing there and I was going nuts and he was going nuts with me, but not really understanding. It was, it's a vivid memory that's, you know, burned into my hardwiring now.
It seems from what you're saying, not only from what you're wearing, but also your trash can. And by the way, very AJ Soprano move, having the Bruins trash can. yeah, it sounds like Bobby Orr was your guy, right? So what did Bobby mean to you?
So he meant a lot to me. He was, I mean, how could he not? He was, I watched that guy, all that highlight stuff that you see on YouTube, if you go on and look at it, I watched all that stuff in real time because I was literally like planted in front of our television growing up every night that they televised the game, and they televised a lot of those games. And so I was just in awe of him. But you know, Don Marcotte and the Chief, Johnny Bucic, those were my guys really. Mostly Johnny Bucic because he was a winger. I was a winger. He was an assist guy, but could also score goals. And, I was more of an assist guy as I got a little older. At first, I just wanted to score goals all the time. but I just didn't quite have the shot. I worked awful hard. But so it was the Chief and Don Marcotte, really, and then probably Bobby Orr. Bobby Orr was just in a different, you know, it was like that guy was he was in a different, you know, universe. It was
right.
It was like watching an alien play almost, because he was right. And sort of like Daniel Day-Lewis in the acting world. It's like, that guy's an extraterrestrial. I don't really believe what he's doing as a human.
Right.
It was and it was jaw dropping. You know, you've seen all that stuff. You know,
oh yeah.
Like it's insane.
Oh, yeah. You know, not to be too pop psychologist here, but you know, you wanted to be the goal scorer, you ended up being the assist guy. And then in the acting world, you know, the world is split up into the lead guys and guys like you that do all the heavy lifting and the hard work and the fourth line stuff. can we draw the parallel between your acting and your hockey play, sir?
Absolutely.
I wanted to get into.
No, I mean, I'm happy about that. You know, I'm grateful to even have that because I love what I do. Just like if I was playing, you know, if I was playing with David Backus right now and Sean Corrali and, or, you know, those guys, Johansson, if I was playing on the bottom six of any team, let alone the Bruins, I would be a happy man. And I've, you know, more than happy. It's a privilege. And so also in my profession, I get asked to participate in some pretty wicked stories directed by some pretty great people, you know, written by some great people with some amazing actors that I can be there to support. So absolutely you can make that comparison.
I'm going to bug you about your acting in one second, but I wanted to ask you about Marchand because he's been in the news this week. He pissed off a reporter. He did this whole thing. What do you think of Brad? I feel like when you look through the Bruins lens, everybody loves him, but are you able to take a step back and take a critical look at him? Or do you think the outsiders who criticize the guy are kind of off base?
I didn't really hear what happened. I heard like
no sold an interview a couple times, but I just mean in general. I mean the face licking, the agitation, the pest thing, the Ken Linsman stuff.
I don't know about that. You know, it's like, do you play the game? Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's you know, the guy, you know, he's a great player. He's a great player and stuff happens on the ice. And, you know, far be it for me to like know what's going on in Brad Marchand's mind. I love the way he plays. I love the way he gets into other people's heads. I play against guys like that and they drive me nuts. and it affects my play and it takes me off. Not that I'm any shakes of a good hockey player, but it throws me. And so, especially guys that are really highly skilled. And then, you know, I'm getting burned left and right, but that doesn't, you know, I don't know. I think the guy, I just sort of, I'm going to, I love him.
I think him. That's a default Bruins.
And then I think, I think he, there's a part of him, I don't know.
You know, no, I feel you.
He's in it, and then he also has to have his relationship because he's got to have a relationship with the media. And I don't know, you know, what his motivations are. And again, far be it for me to like say what I think they are, but I think he's a great hockey player and, you know, like everybody, they say something wrong or what, but
I think it's a typical Bruins fan response.
The Bruins is what I'm saying.
Right, like you live with the other stuff because the guy pops in 30 goals and does a good job. I think that's the default setting for Bruins fans. All right, let me ask you a few career things. A lot of people that are listening to this probably know you from The Night Of on HBO, which was huge for you. I mean, nomination, that whole bit. You've worked on both that and The Leftovers, and I wanted to get your take on prestige TV and the differences working in that medium versus in film.
So there are two different forms, obviously, and with a film, you know, the thing is that both of those television shows, and the one I'm working on now, and The Looming Tower, those were long form, right? Those were 8 to 10 episodes or something, and so we got to spend, in, let's say, a network television show, a little more time working on stuff. Specifically with scenes and digging a little deeper and trying more things as one gets to do on a movie set. So there's a gratification when working on a movie set because you don't feel so rushed, you know, for time. Obviously money is time in both of those venues, but it's a little less so on a film. You really get to like, you know, possibly explore more. In the arena, if you will, of the set. I don't know if I have a preference for one or the other. oftentimes with a long form television. What did you call it? Prestige TV? Is that because
Yeah, the prestige training? TV. That's your you know, it started I think probably with Sopranos and then went to Mad Men and Breaking Bad. The prestige TV is your high minded television shows that people look at and say are every bit as good as the films being made today.
Well, the advantage to that is that you also have a long form. Like I'm going to start something in Germany in August mm-hmm. when I finish with the thing I'm doing now. Well, the thing I'm doing now, which is based on a novel, I'm not really positive how much I can talk about it, so I'm going to be sort of cryptic with it.
Ooh.
I know. I think it's fine, but, you know, it's an HBO show, and so it's 10 episodes, but it may do what the Leftovers thing did, which was we're telling the story of the novel in eight episodes, as opposed to, which is an 8-hour movie, or 10-hour movie, as opposed to
right.
doing a 2-hour cramming of a 400-page novel, right? 450-page mm-hmm. novel. There's mm-hmm. that advantage, which was, you know, amazing. And then, because also there are so many awesome writers out there, then they're going to, and we have the best on this show, Richard Price, Dennis Lehane, then we can go off, and after that story is told, it's the kind of story like Leftovers, where then you can just duck, you know?
Yeah. If it's Dennis Lehane, are you shooting it in Boston?
No. But it's it's the possibility of then going on endlessly for years and years.
Right.
Leftovers did, I think, what,
right.
3 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Night Of is still sort of pending, or I don't know, that could be done. But, a film, you're sort of obligated and forced to tell something within the 2-hour format, which is mm-hmm. which is a problem, but then there are also great cons to it as well.
Yeah.
Or pros, rather.
Speaking of film, what was it like getting thrown off a roof by Jason Bourne?
So listen, this is an interesting story. I don't know if you've ever talked to Matt, but he would tell you this. So we were up there on that roof. And I volunteered to let Matt throw me off, you know, to the stunt guy and to Paul and the producers. And I said, yeah, I'll do it. Because the stunt guy came over to me and was like, this is what's going to happen. And he was the guy who had done that James Bond movie, Casino Royale or Skyfall or whatever the last one was, or prior to the last one. And I said, sure. And they rigged me in, and then they said, no, you can't do it. And so thusly, what we had, so the stunt guy actually did the fall off the roof, but I did get to, like, get harnessed in, and Matt held me off the roof. And so I had Jason Bourne like screaming in my face with a Glock at my forehead after he kicked my ass for like an entire elevator ride up to the thing, which we did a bunch of different times. And I lost like a 300 pair of glasses, like these special glasses that like the guy I'm playing wears, rimless glasses, you know, that like bend and stuff. And they'd gone out.
Yeah.
And of course they have like more money than God on those movies. And so they got like two pairs of these super expensive glasses for me that looked great. And it was like, take one. And Matt and I came into it and he chucked me against the wall. And I'm like, boom. The glasses fly off and they go down like this crack in the elevator. Two floors down and they can't find them, and I don't know, it was awesome.
Oh,
it was great.
Geez.
It was really, you know, tremendous.
Alright, last one, because I'm and this is a completely selfish question: how great is this Joker movie going to be?
It's kind of bonkers. I think I have not seen this movie, but I think it's going to be pretty great, like spectacular, you know. I know it's going to, you know, it's not going to be at all what you expect. I can't say anything other than that it's going to be awesome. It's going to be fantastic. Joaquin Phoenix, I think, is, you know, he's amazing. He lives it, man. He totally lives it. It's like,
yeah.
Yeah, and for this movie, I mean, it's kind of like, really, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm going to go for it. So when you listen to Orr talk about, you know, playing back then with those guys, and of course, that guy in particular, because of all of his knee problems and, like, no cartilage, and, but then playing, like, every other shift, you know, every half shift, maybe, and then having to get out of bed and go and then get it together and, you know, give another amazing performance. You know, Joaquin gives everything all the time. So, and he's such a physical actor, you know, he just, you know, embodies these people he's playing. So, you know, kills it, crushes it every freaking scene. That, I mean, I'm in the movie for who knows, like 2 minutes total or something. I don't know, but that guy, I think, is in every scene of this film. But I don't know. Don't quote me on that. But of course, it's Joker, and it's the Joker, and it's Joaquin, and it's a brilliant script that Todd wrote. And it's, you know, the rest of the cast is so killer. But that guy's so special, you know, Joaquin Phoenix. And since I saw him for the very first time, it's just, you know, I marvel at what he does.
Awesome. Our thanks to Bill Camp for joining us on Puck Soup. Hopefully you enjoyed that interview with a one of those journeyman players in Hollywood. You've seen him in everything. If you know him, you know the face, you know the voice, you know the whole thing. Maybe you've even seen him on stage in something like The Crucible. And if you want to see The Crucible or any of Arthur Miller's plays, there's only one place to go, and that's with SeatGeek.
B's
generous. B minus at best.
Well, I just heard a goal horn go off, so clearly it was great.
Bad transition. My police have arrived.
The ticket industry hasn't changed in a long time. There's a bunch of big companies who have been around forever, but they don't really care about making the experience easier for the customer. That's why you got to go with SeatGeek. With more than 50,000 five-star reviews in the App Store, SeatGeek is clearly a ticket company that puts the customer first. It pulls in millions of tickets from all over the web, rates each deal on a scale of 1 to 10, and displays them on an interactive seat map. The aforementioned big green circles. It's so simple to find what you're looking for. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets with confidence. I've got the SeatGeek app on my phone. It's the way I go to, you know, whether it's like Shakespeare in the Park or The Crucible. I'm kidding. I just go to musicals. But I also go to hockey games and comedy shows and all other things. And I use SeatGeek to get all those tickets because it's the easiest way to shop for these tickets. In fact, it's the way I'm going to use – it's the manner in which I will use a ticket app to get tickets to the New York sports teams when they come through the Bay Area to come see the Mets lose. Best of all, the listeners of Puck Soup get $10 off their first SeatGeek purchase when you use our promo code SOUP. SeatGeek supports this show. Please support SeatGeek. That's $10 off your first purchase of concert tickets, sports, comedy, whatever you want. Use the promo code SOUP on the app and get $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. During the interview, we were having a brief discussion of Charlize Theron. Both Ryan and I saw Longshot recently, and both really liked it. If you're looking for a good rom-com to take your lady, but also a movie that has cum jokes.
Yeah, I was going to say Seth Rogen style humor abounds.
Yeah, it's solid. And also, like, not necessarily, like, there's sometimes when you see a political comedy, I'm thinking specifically of The Distinguished Gentleman, the Eddie Murphy movie from years back. Well, you're
not
like
familiar at all.
Yeah, exactly. Because it wasn't good. He plays. He goes to. It's like a Mr. Smith Goes to Washington kind of deal. Not good because it didn't feel genuine. I feel like this also had a little bit of enough behind the scenes of the way that the Secretary of State operates and yada 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 that you feel okay about the politics of the whole thing and the inside of it. it was really funny. And Shirley is what a fucking treasure. I mean, is there anything this woman can't do? I mean, granted, her scenes in that Fast and Furious movie were probably shot on a soundstage and she didn't interact with any of the cast. That's fine. It wasn't really that good. But she was awesome as Furiosa and she's awesome in this movie. And Ryan and I both give it a big thumbs up from your friends at Puck Soup to go see this movie. It'll be great, I think, hopefully.
Will be. We both saw it. It is very good. So,
I'm bummed that the Avatar sequels aren't coming out for a while. Disney displayed its slate of movies that are going to be coming out, and it's going to be a rotation of Star Wars movies and Avatar sequels through 2027. Shit.
Yeah, very optimistic about where society's going that they're planning that far out. I do not share their enthusiasm.
Well, you know.
Guys, tell me this, okay? I'm one of the – I think I'm the only one based on the box office who never saw Avatar. Do I need to see
– No, it sucks.
No, you don't need to see it. It's very bad.
That was the impression I was under.
It's not good.
Okay.
Yeah. Not good.
Because I was in when we had the kids at Disney World, they have this whole Avatar land now, and we went in there and we were looking at stuff, and my kids are like, "What's that?" And I'm like, "I have no idea." And like this lady comes up, she's like, "Have you not seen Avatar?" And I was like, "No." And she's like, "Well, the premise of the movie," and I was like, "No, I didn't ask to like."
Pandora. Like, no, I, yeah. It was a great cinematic experience because of the 3D at the time. I mean, that's for sure, right?
Like, that was why I saw it. Yeah, and like it did a good job of like doing 3D technology in a way that really hadn't been done before ever. And that, and you know, did the typical James Cameron shit of like he personally invented all of the 3D tech that was used in the making of the film. Like, he's an incredibly impressive guy and filmmaker and all that kind of stuff, but the movie itself, not good.
Okay.
I'll say this about two things. First of all, I really find it funny that people point to the lines at Disney World or Disneyland or Disney World, I guess it is, for these Avatar rides being like, well, you know, people say there isn't anticipation for these sequels, but look at the lines at these rides. I'm like, yeah, that must be why Tomorrowland was such a huge hit. You know, if you're going to base a film's potential success on how long the lines are.
I can't wait till the fucking Teacups movie comes out.
And then the other thing, too, is that it's just like I don't know if these movies are going to be good, but I do know that when people bet against James Cameron, they're usually wrong. Like the Titanic thing will go down in history as one of the greatest fuck yous in the history of pop culture. Like, everybody was predicting this movie was going to be trash and that it was going to bomb. It was going to be a money boondoggle. And then it comes out and it is like the biggest hit of all time. And I will always cherish that moment where, you know, the king of the world moment for James Cameron of people saying that you're shit and then you put out your art and then everybody's like, ah, fuck, it was great, wasn't it? Made me happy.
Well, I mean, it wasn't great, but it made a ton of money. Like, everybody my age saw it 40 times in theaters and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. There it is. All right, let's briefly talk about a couple of other things here. The Oilers hire Kent Holland. So I saw that our friends in the Oilers media are really optimistic now because Ken told them that he had a great culture in Detroit and that culture could come to Edmonton. You have to respect the jersey and all that. I thought that his introductory press conference was fine. I think he said a lot of good things. I thought he said a lot of weird things, like, let's let the young players percolate in the minor leagues for several years instead of putting them right in the lineup, because in 2019, every young player excels when you put them in the lineup straight away. And I also feel like there wasn't enough lip service paid to how fucking heavy the lift is going to be for this guy to try to reshape this roster that Peter Chiarelli left him.
Well, I mean, look, the Red Wings very famously got by on, well, we can just keep, you know, Gustav Nyquist in the AHL until he's 25 years old or you know, that kind of thing. And that works when you have, I don't know, let's say 2, 3, 4 Hall of Famers on the roster.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I don't know that works when, you know, your second best right or left wing is still Milan Lucic somehow. You know, like, That's the real issue I have with all that optimism of like the culture and because Oilers people like media guys have been saying for months like the Oilers don't let kids be in the AHL for long enough and that kind of thing, and it's like in some cases that's true. In other cases, you know, like the idea that you would just blanket apply that to every like because they got they. I mean, these are the same people who got all excited for Kyler Yamamoto when he had like 2 goals in the preseason or whatever, and they put him on the roster through their sheer enthusiasm. I don't know, man. Like, I think you got to be pretty. I don't want to say naive, but like it's in the neighborhood of naive for sure to be like, hey, all the stuff Ken Holland did right in like 1999, that's what he's going to do in Edmonton. And all the stuff he didn't do right every year since then, I've never like that doesn't look like anything to me. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like that doing Westworld shit with it where he's just like I'm the Justin Abdelkader contract, I mean, that's not analogous to anything at all in Edmonton. It's like, get a fucking grip, dude. And, like, Sean. the other thing I want to say real quick, and then I'll let Sean talk because I've been talking for a while, is all this stuff about, like, it's actually ageism to say Ken Holland's not good at his job. And it's like, no, it isn't. What the fuck are you talking about? Hope he sees this one, bro. Like, but it's not... It's not ageism to say
it's a little ageist to say that he like the game has passed him by.
Why? Like, why is that ageist to say? I mean, it's not ageist to say about Peter Chiarelli, is that because Peter Chiarelli's younger, or is it because Peter Chiarelli more demonstrably has had it pass him by?
I think the motivation for it is because these guys are older. I mean, the same thing was said about Jim Rutherford before he went to Pittsburgh. I mean, I agree with you that that you can't like using ageism as the fucking Captain America shield to deflect all criticism to Ken Holland is bullshit. There's a touch of it, don't you think, in the criticism of Ken Holland?
No, I don't think that. That's what I just said.
Yeah, I think it's very reasonable to point out that with some of these guys, Ken Holland, Rutherford, Lou Lamoriello would be another one, where to counter the enthusiasm for look how many cups they've won, look how much success they've had by pointing out that this league really has changed radically in even, you know, not even since the cap. I mean, even the
5 years, yeah.
5 years. So, you know, the fact that somebody won a cup in 2002 doesn't necessarily tell you all that much. I don't mind this hire, and I certainly think it's a better hire than what the other option seemed to be, which was either Keith Gretzky, which I've never seen an organization so aggressively float trial balloons before of just constantly feeding his name into the media to try to gauge whether they could get away with hiring him. I wouldn't have been a big fan of that. I wouldn't have been a big fan of Mark Hunter. Even Kelly McCrimmon, for reasons he kind of got into, I wouldn't necessarily have been as high on my list as he seemed to be. So I, you know, going with a more known quantity like Ken Holland, it feels like a little bit higher floor, a little bit lower ceiling, maybe. But maybe that's what you need, because you have a once-in-a-lifetime franchise player who could... potentially, you know, if you screw this one up and you're doing the same thing 2 or 3 years from now, it could become a problem by that point. So I kind of view this as, I mean, it could be a mess. He could come in and try to do everything like he did in 2002, and he could come in and talk about the culture and then keep all the same people that the Oilers already have, and it could all be a disaster. It could also be a situation kind of like when Lou Lamoriello came to Toronto, where he was the perfect guy for a few years there to guide the transition, to be the veteran voice in the room. You know, I want to see if Ken Holland is going to bring in like his version of Kyle Dubas or his version of whoever that the next, you know, the younger, fresher set of eyes. If he starts building out a staff that way to the point where you go, you know what, even if Ken Holland only wants to do this for 5 years, we know who the next GM is going to be because there's a plan in place. Then I think it's going to be okay. You know, Lou Lamoriello lasted 3 years in Toronto, but I think it was the right 3 years, you know, and then it was the right moment to move on when it was. I could see that being, you know, if I'm an Oilers fan, that's kind of what I'm looking at, saying maybe that's what you're hoping we get here, and it's not just the old timer getting up on stage and playing all his greatest hits from before you were born, and that's the end of it.
The guy they should have hired is Bill Zito, but they're not going to hire him because he's American. He is the best guy out there that's not a GM. He doesn't have GM experience. He's the assistant GM in Columbus, and apparently, by all accounts, the guy really running the show there. So I think that would be the best choice. But I understand why they pick Kenny. And, you know, the only reason that I think it could be good is if what should happen happens, which is that he firewalls his operation away from all the old boys network guys. They're obviously not going anywhere. The Oilers are never getting rid of fucking Paul Coffey or Kevin Lowe or Craig McTavish. So the best you can hope is that you create enough space between your operation and their input or their influence that you can work autonomously. So the two reasons I like this for the Oilers is, one, I think Kenny Holland's one of the few guys that could walk into that place and be like, fuck you, your opinion means fucking nothing to me. I'm Ken Holland, motherfucker. Which would be great if, you know, fly on the wall time to hear that. And then the other thing is that the primary task ahead for Ken Holland is to get this team really fucking good within about 2 years, because otherwise Connor's going to lose his mind. And so if you bring in a novice GM who might not necessarily have the relationships with other GMs around the league, it might be tougher to make the kinds of deals that Ken's going to have to make with the limited assets that he has. But if you have Ken Holland, who's worked with these guys for the upwards of 2 decades, maybe, just maybe, it's going to be easier to move some of these pieces and change around the roster a little bit. So to that end, I kind of like the idea of him being there, even if I like other guys that were up for the job a little bit more.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think if Mark Hunter comes in and starts firing old-timers, then I think you can imagine how quickly that would potentially go bad in certain segments of the Edmonton media. So maybe
it sounds like, it sounds like Hunter's gonna end up in Seattle though, huh? Maybe, potentially.
We'll see. He's you know, from all accounts, he's a bright guy and a hockey lifer. I don't know that he's done enough that I would want to hand him the keys to my whole team. I think his draft record in Toronto is getting pumped up by people who maybe haven't looked at it beyond Mitch Marner.
And pumped up by people that used to use them as a source all the time. I do like this new paradigm that we're in, where the GM becomes the president of hockey operations, and then the assistant GM is the GM. Like, everything's kind of shifted up a space, it seems like, in the last like few months.
Yeah.
It's a pretty good deal. Brad Marchand, finally, the little ball of hate, treating our friend Kyle Bisakis like an asshole after the Game 6 victory, and then being a prick in the locker room to the rest of the media. It's Marchand. He's putting himself over. It is what it is. My take on this whole thing was that, you know, I always thought, if I put myself in that situation, if I played that role, if I was Kyle, or if I was, you know, Brian Boucher after a game putting a microphone in somebody's face, I would say 2 times out of every 10, there's going to be a guy that hates me that comes up to me and just like no sells an interview or calls me an asshole on the air or something. Like, I always assume that's going to happen. So in this situation, I'm not surprised that Marchand is a prick to somebody who he thought was a prick to him. The two takeaways I have on this one is this. I know people have taken a run at Kyle for trying to joke with Marchand before a game. The world is split up into two types of NHL players: those that play along with us and those that don't. And Marchand, every fucking time you talk to him and you need something out of him for a story or whatever, or a quip or whatever, he plays along. So the idea that he didn't play along in that moment should not be on the reporter, because it is well established that Marchand's the guy you can fuck around with.
Yep.
And then the other thing too is that in talking to some people about this, and I might write about this on Friday, the real issue isn't Marchand or any of these guys, Brent Burns or any of these guys that are kind of pricks to the media. The issue is the people watching them being pricks to the media. The issue is the other guys in like the Bruins locker room that are like 21 or 22 that see the way Marchand treats us.
I don't know.
Oh, dude, it gives them carte fucking blanche to pass it to every generation on how you don't have to be better about your interactions with the public. I fucking guarantee you that.
I don't know, man. Like, I one thing I've really liked in the last couple of years is that, like, more NHL players are just like, oh, when that happened, I was like, holy fuck. And that's just, like, the quote that gets in the story or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's great because it's so much better than, well, you know, I was just going hard to the net and I was just fortunate to have my stick in the right place when my teammates got me the puck. And, yeah, just fortunate to be in that position and glad we got the win. Like, I want guys to have a personality. And it's like, again, I'm a big NBA fan. And, like, Joel Embiid is an asshole, right? and his shtick, you can say his shtick's a little tired. And I kind of agree with that. But also, like, you get guys like Giannis Antetokounmpo, who's one of the biggest sweeties in the whole world, and like he's posting funny videos on his Instagram and all that kind of stuff. And like nobody in the NBA is looking at Joel Embiid going, "That's the guy I want to be like." And nobody is necessarily looking at Giannis and going, "I need to be exactly as nice as Giannis." Because then I'll get to be in commercials and all that kind of stuff. Like, Joel Embiid's in commercials. So there, it doesn't I don't think it redounds to, okay, well, you know, they're going to see two guys in the league who are well known for being elite players being dicks to the media, and they're going to go, now I get to be a dick to the media. I think everybody's different, and, you know, you, in much the same way in any other workplace, you can identify, well, like, that guy's good at his job, but he's a prick. Like, you're not going to go, and I should also be a prick if I want to be as good at my job as him. Because Patrice Bergeron's the nicest guy in the world, and nobody's, like, saying that he's, you know, everybody's just trying to be exactly like Patrice Bergeron because he's the nicest guy.
Right.
Like, I think guys that want to be pricks are going to be pricks, and if guys don't want to be pricks, they're not going to be.
Yeah, I mean, I hate when stuff like this comes up because we can't win, because if we ignore it, then we're letting guys get away with it, and if we talk about it, then it's the media being interested in the media, and it's more navel-gazing and all of this stuff. I'll just say this, like, for this whole thing with the pregame interview that somehow excuses this, that people immediately found and started circulating, because of course you have to be a contrarian on Twitter and show that you're above this stuff. And, you know, if people haven't seen it, you know, Kyle makes a joke to him, but it's not just some random joke that he pulled out of nowhere. Kyle was making a reference to a joke that Brad Marchand himself made the day before.
Yep.
Where he was asked about, like, hey, we saw you stomp on a guy's stick. That was interesting how you were trying to cheat in overtime. What was the deal with that? And he made light of it and said, yeah, no, I think it was the other guy was just trying to dull my skate blade with his stick. Okay, fine. That's a good soundbite. You're playing it off as a joke. That's cool. But you can't joke about it and then the next day get all cranky because somebody makes the same joke back to you. And don't give me this about the sanctity of the pregame warm-up, like, oh, he was about to go out and play a game.
What the fuck
you
is
can't...
that? Who said nobody said that?
He's minutes away from game time. You can't joke with him then.
People said that. People said he's minutes away from game time, yeah.
Fucking
brainworms in this sport, man.
Look, got the fucking brainworms, because, like, it's not as if Pierre Maguire doesn't fuck around with these guys and joke around with these guys every single time he talks to them before the game.
It's a constant thing, but here's the thing. So, He was being a baby, if that really was what upset him, but fine. Let's give him the right to be a baby about it. Then just don't do the post-game interview. You know, it's that simple. Hey, Brad, do you mind doing Hockey Night Canada? Yeah, actually, I do mind. I've got a problem with Kyle. I don't want to do it. Great. Patrice, will you do it? Sure. And then off we go, and nobody's talking about it, and it's a non-story. But he didn't do that because he didn't want it to be a non-story. He wanted it to be a story. He basically went on live TV and tried to embarrass a guy who was just doing his job. And that's just such a dick move. I'm sorry. I know it's not the end of the world. I know, you know, at the end of it, we'll probably won't remember it a week from now. But I'm just, like, I'm at a point in my life where I've got no patience for people who act like that. Even if you think incorrectly that he was somewhat justified in being unhappy, like, you know, we've all been to a restaurant and had a waiter get our order wrong. you're justified at not being happy about that. But if you stand up and decide you're going to try to embarrass this guy in front of everyone, you're being a huge asshole. There's no reason to behave like that. And that's, you know, that was Brad Marchand tried to embarrass this guy. He failed because Kyle handled it perfectly. Like, he absolutely...
he really did.
he realized what was happening. He kind of played into it, but didn't escalate it. Like, he found the perfect balance. And it was Brad Marchand who ended up looking like an idiot. And, you know, does it matter? Like, no, he's a good player. He might win the Conn Smythe, and, you know, we all move on. I just, you know, I have no patience for this stuff anymore. Like, this is just... Don't be a jerk, for the sake of it, because you can get away with it. Like, that's...
These kinds of things come up, and they're usually handled behind the scenes. They're usually like a player grabs you after a you know, locker room availability, and just you hash it out, and you'll light you up occasionally. I mean, that's just how it works. But, like, you know, I doubt that there was a single conversation between Marchand and Kyle before this one went on television.
No, just say no. But then we wouldn't be talking about it. And obviously, even after the biggest win of the season, there was a part of him that felt it was important to make sure people knew that he was mad at somebody in the media by trying to embarrass him in front of a million people watching on TV. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just, screw that guy. Honestly, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. All right. Question of the week. Give us your Conn Smythe leader at this point. Patrick H. writes in, Joe Pavelski's grandmother. Did you see Joe Pavelski's grandmother on Twitter yesterday?
Yeah, that was good.
Oh, what a fucking sweetheart. Just adorable. That's when I knew he was in. Jeremy Tuck says, Joe Thornton's beard is starting to resemble the Stanley Cup in height and color. That's pretty good. Mm-hmm. That's a good line. Let's see here. Matthew Lopner says, between Tuukka, Hurdle, and Slavin Turbo for me. I think Tuukka and Hurdle are probably your clubhouse leaders for the Conn Smythe at this point.
Yeah.
Michael Holmes says Logan Couture for me. Carlson is an outsider because of his point total so far. If he steps up for the Western Conference Final and the final, then maybe he's got a chance. Rask for Boston, Schwartz for the Blues, Slavin for the Canes, just to hedge my bet. I think Vlasic might have a better claim at the Conn than does Carlson, but that's just me. John Fisher says Puck Luck might be the leader for the Conn Smythe.
Yeah.
Puck Luck.
Yeah, bad penalty calls.
Mm-hmm. And Jim Fitzgerald says Ben Bishop, without a doubt, he carried the Stars through that last game. They had no chance without him. Jim making the case that, and this is a classic think piece, that a player that didn't advance in the playoffs should still be able to win the Conn Smythe. That was my argument the year Jiggy won, because I thought Gaborik deserved it for having played three great rounds. That was my hot take.
I don't think two rounds is enough, but yeah, like,
yeah,
Eric Carlson a few years ago with the Senators would be another one where
I like that. Yeah. Oh, we're on the same page. A player that maybe like goes deep into the third round and is demonstrably the most valuable player of the playoffs can win the Conn Smythe, which I know is, you probably think that's off brand for me considering my feelings about Connor McDavid and the Hart Trophy, but
I wasn't going to say anything, but all right.
It's a totally different award.
It's
all right. That's Puck Soup for this week. God willing, next time we talk, it will not be about the officiating. I'm Greg Wyshynski. You can listen to my other podcast, ESPN and Ice, with Emily Kaplan, and find my stuff on ESPN, and I'm on Twitter, at Wyshynski.
I'm Ryan Lambert. You can sign up for the Puck Soup newsletter every week. $4 if you just want the newsletter, $3 if you want that, plus the $5 bonus episodes, and you can get it all on our Patreon.
You can find me on The Athletic this week. Thursday's Post is the annual all-playoff bust team, a full roster of everyone who has let us down. And then on Friday in the grab bag, among a bunch of other things, I've got a YouTube breakdown of the play that is largely responsible for the Ben Bishop rule we saw this week, the infamous Alexei Kovalev slashing incident in which he died during a game against the Nordiques. Got a goal taken off the board and then miraculously came back to life to help them help the Rangers win the game.
Miraculous player. All right, that's Puck Soup for this week. Thanks for listening. Everybody check out the mailbag on the Patreon, and we'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Bye.
Later.
Sticks and hits and goals and saves and slap shots and goons. We've got sportly commentary to whatever your commute. But we also cover movies, TV shows, hits and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hockey and nonsense. Box soup.